You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Conversation with People in Art. This is Jen Graves, and I'm at Seattle Art Museum with Corin Hewitt.
Hi.
Hi.
You have a show that's just opening today here. We're recording this on Friday, April 3rd, and it's in the Sam Next Gallery, which is a space that is reserved for contemporary artists working regionally, nationally, internationally. You're based in New York, and the last performance you did was something called Seed Stage at the Whitney, and that was actually performance number 3. This show is a series of photographs from performance number 2, which you did in Portland in 2007. Mm-hmm. And then there's a performance number 1, which was in Red Hook, New York.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, and that was when you were still in graduate school at BART.
Yeah, it was right? My final project. I consider this a series of work within
these.
These photographs and these performances, and they are an evolving series of work, which encompass some sort of open viewing of the making of photographs, and then the photographs themselves. Each of the projects will have a component where people can get to see me making photographs, and then people get to see the photographs separately, and then there also will hopefully be a book for each component where the photographs sit out of scale and out of context in a book. So the ideal is that each one will have three components, and then they will take the material from the previous one and integrate it with a new set of material depending on the site of each following performance and group of photography.
Okay. And just to be specific about people, for people who haven't, read about Seed Stage, there were a series of materials that were involved in that, but part of what you did is you were in there, on weekends for 3 months?
I was there for 3.5 days a week.
And you were working, and working meant everything from growing your food, making your meals, creating the food that you were using to make your meals in plasticine sculptures, taking photographs of the sculptures and of the foods, and composting your foods, taking photographs of the compost, composting the photographs, and all of that was taking place inside an internal room that had a frieze of a color spectrum around the top, and the outsides of those walls, there were 4 places,
apertures
at the corners for people to look in. Mm-hmm. And then on the outsides of those walls was sort of a changing exhibition of the photograph that you were making.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this kind of way that you put it in the preview this morning where there was this kind of question about what were the materials that you were holding on to,
mm-hmm.
and which materials were you letting go of,
mm-hmm.
and in what forms.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were going to eat a pear, you would make a pear, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or, for example, maybe, then the pear that you ate would end up going to compost, but the pear that you sculpted would end up being in a photograph with the pear that you ate, or, something like that.
Right.
And the experience of going through this gallery is that there's no performance aspect per se in this, since the performance aspect already happened. So there's kind of this is sort of the flip side of that event. But you spend a lot of time looking at these photographs and seeing repeating elements in different forms. So you'll see, you've taken in Portland. You went to the museum and took images from their website of the objects that they have, and then went to Goodwill and went to the fabric store, and then you have also spent a little time making, a lot of time making those objects that you found in Portland, making them yourself, and sort of, making a basket very similar to the basket you see that's in the Portland Museum collection, but out of pasta,
mm-hmm.
And then making the photograph, and then maybe taking that photograph and incorporating that in another photograph that's involved with other materials. And so what I think is helpful for people to understand is that the materials themselves you keep sort of some kind of hold on. Some of them you let go of, but there is a body of materials that you are hanging on to as well,
mm-hmm.
Throughout each performance, throughout, the whole trajectory of what you've been working on,
mm-hmm.
all these locations and performances.
Mm-hmm.
What is driving you?
I think it's a very basic, for me, it's a very basic problem that we all face of being born into a world that already exists, and how do we struggle with the fact that we occupy a space in this world for a limited time, and we receive a wide variety of materials and histories in which we have a choice on how to engage with those histories, how to act within them, whether we want to reproduce and keep aspects of what we receive around, or if we want to change them. So these are very basic choices that, as humans, we face. And I think each one of these circumstances or bodies of photographs that I produce is a life of its own. It's an experience within a certain time, a certain set of conditions in which one explores those choices that we all make, the values that we have. I think it gets to some basic question of what our values are, and also our propensity and our drive to produce and to reproduce, both biologically reproduce, but also mechanically reproduce objects around us. Mm-hmm. So different things have different lifespans, objects also. And it's interesting to think about why objects have lifespans.
For this series, you used four different cameras for this mm-hmm. particular performance. Polaroid, 4x5, 35mm digital, which leaves me with the kind of feeling of almost a film crew sort of surveying a scene from so many different angles and then kind of putting together this one film out of many possible films. And in your work, and what we see is we get a glimpse of the many possible films that could have come out. And you've talked about this a little bit as a kind of part of thinking about the periphery and kind of allowing that the problem of the periphery into the photograph, which I think is really interesting. One problem that I have, and just as a person, I have a really hard time taking pictures at all, because I feel like I'm always missing something that's mm-hmm. going on when I'm trying to take this picture. I always have the sense that I'm not taking the right picture. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of back down from the whole enterprise. But this is a way of engaging the periphery so that it all builds, you know, these images kind of build on each other.
Yeah, I think that part of it is that one has an inclination to make something out of the world, and while you are making that thing, a goal-driven activity, whatever it is, whether it's holding on to and making a house that you've, you know, basing it on a previous house and producing this house, that in the making of that house, I like to know myself by seeing the process in which I make that house. And that is the way in which I can know myself from being different than the house itself. So there's a way in which you could call it the periphery, or you could call it the time structure, or the engagement with time in the formation of a thing, maybe all that we have. And that may be the fact of our lives, that we are just forming, in constant states of forming. And there may be no thing to form except to continue to form. This was a question for me in the body of objects in Oregon. When we have an art museum, we talk about objects of origin and cultures of origin. And I never really understood why a thing could be original. I think it has a problem of having parents that you feel that they were the origin of you. And so we look for origins in the world, and we look for foundations, and whether it's religious and in the name of God or in the name of the Big Bang, we want beginnings. And I think it comes out of a very basic struggle of the fact that we knew that we didn't exist at some point. Or how did we exist? Does everyone before us exist within us? And will we forever potentially exist within both the memory and objects and the use of those objects in the future? Or are we just another material in a state of continuum? And that's a question that I feel I wanted to raise by investigating objects that have claims of originality.
I was reading an interview with you in Maybe Modern Painters, where you're talking about the anxiety of reproduction. And that struck me as, you know, really, really important to who we are and how we think about what we do and being ourselves, this kind of idea that you're always inside some many, many processes of reproduction at once and at the same time trying to be a thing that is separate from all those processes. And in the work, there's also, there's the anxiety of reproduction and also the acknowledgement of reproduction as a way to soothe the anxiety of decay. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fruit in your work that, you know, there's a, I think in this particular series, I noticed a cantaloupe that has just a rotting end. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, it's just poignant symbol that the thing was rotting, and now we have this photograph of the thing, but we only have a photograph of the thing in a state of rotting. You know, mm-hmm. it's a question of photography's relationship to permanence really starts to come into it.
Yeah, it's also, you could also think of it as like you're having an Italian meal, but there's still an Italian cookbook. You know, so you can consume the thing that has and photography can serve as a foundational recipe for future behavior. I think that people look to photographs as both a model to aspire to and also a knowledge of where things are from. So there's that photography both grabs at something that's passing, but it also becomes a foundation to build things on top of. So in that way, the rotting fruit only acknowledges the fact that the cantaloupe itself is a tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a biological, you could call the evolution of a fruit a tradition, but it's in biological terms as opposed to cultural terms.
When I look at this work, you know, I'm thinking about, in addition to performance, I mean, because at Seattle Art Museum there isn't a performative aspect, you know, directly. You're not in the gallery performing something, which I gotta say, I wish that you were. I like the two of them being so united. I think that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, in Portland there was no exhibition space for these images, so this is actually, it kind of brings those two events together. Mm-hmm. For those who had the experience of this performance in Portland, they'll want to see this mm-hmm. stuff too, these photographs. But also there's, you know, a way they're hung kind of in, what would I want to say, just sort of packed together and not in a regular linear, you know, line around the gallery. And in various formats and sizes, and it varies. And when I'm looking at them, you know, I was thinking, I had the strangest sort of moment where I thought, you know, this makes me think of series, and this actually makes me think of The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, for instance, which you would never think. I mean, the subject matter has absolutely nothing to do with, you know, Nan Golden's work. It has nothing to do with directly what you're working on, and vice versa. But there's a way in which, you know, especially with that series, I mean, it's a little bit different in other series like The Americans or something, where it's more of a typology. But in something like that series by Nan Golden, there's a way in which you sense a world that you're not a part of, but you're putting the pieces of it together and constantly getting new information about that world and kind of placing it into a certain context in your mind that you're also the author of. So you're mm-hmm. You're part of it, and at the same time, you're aware that it's a process that's happening separate from you. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to know if that sounds crazy to you.
No, not at all.
No,
I think that, well, I mean, the Nan Golden reference, I mean, there's a lot of ways one could equate issues of reproduction and sort of a sexual liberation mm-hmm. or a moments of ecstatic living, you know, also, as things are consumed and eaten, there's a certain ecstasy and sensuality that we may not necessarily equate with human sexual reproduction, but it's not so different to eat a fruit, and then that's how the fruit actually finds its ability to reproduce itself. So there's an orgiastic element between fruits and humans when they're being eaten, or vegetables and humans, and there's a real ballad of sexual dependency you could almost equate there. But also, thinking about that question, I get into that issue of the noun-verb question mm-hmm. of when you have an object that seems to be a noun or a fact, how can you act within it? And maybe it's the movement and the way that we engage with objects, and those become the value choices that we have. And it's that choice, neither positive nor negative, no way do I want to see what I do be a model for others to follow. It's an investigation of choice and a series of options that I find myself both immersed in, but then also reflecting upon.
How did these ideas come to you? Where did you come through on your way to this investigation?
Oh, it's a long, it's probably, a, it's very, I mean, I think it's a number of things. One is my father, well, both of my parents are artists. My father died when I was 20, and it was, he was a painter and a very powerful painter, and my mother is an artist and now a educational toy designer, so there's a real element of play within thought about play in my household growing up. And then there was also a very pedagogical relation to art making. My father was a perceptual abstract painter in the 60s, and then his work sort of emerged from there. Also, my grandfather, one side was a violinist and the other side a high school art teacher. So in some ways I'm manning the family store, and I really see it as myself carrying on a tradition of a series of questions that I inherited. And then there was a very, you know, with my father's death when I was at a pretty formative age, I had to, you know, I think there was a struggle with disappearance. I mean, not to overly psychologize or psychoanalyze my work, but I think it's pretty, like for me, it was pretty clear that I faced death at a point that was really important to me. And I'd also, I was not planning on being an artist until my father died. And then that changed immediately. And then it was sort of the story felt. Partially, my mother, what she was doing was one thing, but I also felt a lot more space to operate. It gave me another room or something to be in, a room of my own, say.
What kind of work did you make at first?
So I was making sculpture. I made some performance where I was in spaces that were removed from the viewer, and I made sculpture where objects were not fully revealed, where people would move around the outside of a space and look in. Yeah, the series, the issues within my sculpture. Minus, well, the performance existed in college, but the sculpture that I made from the age of 20 to 30 to now, I feel has struggled with the same issues.
We've talked a little bit about your performance and photography, but you mentioned in the gallery that you're also working on sculptures right now that are, mm-hmm. I don't know what. I didn't hear very much about it.
I don't know that much about them yet. I'm taking the photographs that I've made in these series of these groupings that we're talking about, and I am either individually trying to struggle with them or conflating a number of them to try to see what happens when I make objects while forgetting the space in which the image was made, so while both having some memory of its state of being, but often the photographs that I take, because I'm taking so many, I don't always remember the circumstance and what existed around the framing of the taking of the photograph. So it allows me an opportunity to reimagine a physical context, both spatially, but also, I mean, I'm both on the backside of what the object would seem to be in the photograph, but then also spatially in surrounding the frame of the photograph. So it allows me to deal with the physical questions of an image and what, and the way an image claims to describe a three-dimensional space.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of an artist in Seattle whose name is Claire Cowie. And she made a work. It was a hanging bird cage that was kind of, looked sort of as though it were dripping with white paint. But hanging in, so it's very beautiful and delicate looking, but on the inside, hanging on the inside, she's a painter. And on the inside were these paintings, hanging on, if I recall right, is sort of these like medallion pieces of fine paper. And on one side of each, the same portrait, face portrait, was on each side, on both sides of one medallion.
Mm-hmm.
So say you would be on one side and on the other side mm-hmm. of one of those hanging medallions.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did is she took all of the people that she's known who've died, and pets actually too, and painted them from memory, and then flipped the medallion over and painted them from memory again.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is as the birdcage hangs, you sort of they sort of move, mm-hmm. and you get this these two views of the same memory,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that kind of problem of photography as it relates to death.
I'm trying a number of different things. One is I'm sculpting things that conflate two objects within an image, so that when you have a color shift, it doesn't mean it's a form shift. So you have something that's adjacent to one another thing, but it actually could be the same form. So you can not just colorize, but you can desaturate something from color and then create a new form out of it. So by remaking something and then making a cast of it, I can deal with the formal misunderstanding as well as a potential, I was just looking at the Bonnard interior, the late, there's a show now at the Met of the Bonnard's late interior paintings. This also happens, I think, in Mirandi's still life paintings, where there's there can be spaces in the paintings where you don't know whether you're looking at figure or ground. And I am really interested in how we perceive figure in relation to ground. Ground, for me, becomes very connected to the use of those fabrics. So the fabric backdrop becomes about the pedestal or a ground or a soil or a foundational history on which we think we can act. So there's one needs to have a ground to have a figure. One needs to have a, you know, and this gets also back into this question or interest in sculpture and, say, Brancusi's work, for example, where he took the pedestal and made it an object. So therefore, the idea of the object may have been the historical foundation, and the pedestal may have been the stripped-down gesture. It may have been the pedestal, what appears to be a pedestal, may have been the figure, and the the sculpture of the figure may have been the ground. So I really like the way one can think about, say, getting back to composting, as spaces where you can where figure and ground start to become more complex.
Whose work are you interested in contemporary-wise?
There's a number of people whose work I would be interested in. I think in terms of the formation of my thinking, I worked for two artists in my early 20s. I worked for Matthew Barney for almost a year when I was 20 and still in college. And I worked for James Turrell the following year. And I think that there's a space between those two artists which I was attracted to, and I approached on my own just out of interest and not even, you know, no interest that I could put words to. Somewhere between those experiences, I think, were profound for me.
I would love to hear a little bit about your father's work. Can you tell?
Absolutely, yeah. He grew up he was quite a precociously talented draftsman and as a kid, as you could say. He grew up in a family where creative activity or where making things was really important. My grandfather, as I said, was a violinist. My grandmother was an avid cook and knitter. But neither of them had completed a college education. My father was the first to go to college. And also, both of them had been, his families had been in the same region of Vermont-New Hampshire border for eight generations. So they were very located and also quite, you know, never had money in that region. So for materially, they were also very located. So my father, I think, through art as a young boy, probably saw potential for expanding and looking at images of the world outside of Vermont. So I think it probably, that was a very important thing for him. But I think he got a full scholarship to Carnegie Mellon for college. And or through that experience, I think at Carnegie Mellon, a lot of young artists were wrestling with the cult of the individual of abstract expressionism and the transductive or, I don't know, transformative role that an artist may have with material. And I think my father felt that it to be way too occult and a bit of hero worship in a way and a mythologizing around the maker when that could become a very dangerous gesture, especially looking back around the ways in which political figures get mythologized and how people follow the gestures of political figures. And I think that that kind of hero worship can actually make a very passive spectator or participant in the society. So I think for him, trying to find a way to break down the elements of perception became really important. And so he started making very hard-edged pedagogical paintings about perception, size change, overlap, value intensity shifts, all of these things that inform us when we're perceiving a two-dimensional image about what lies in front and what lies behind. So for him, he wanted to deconstruct and simultaneously educate and be, I think in his mind, open up seeing to people and to say, oh, it is maybe just about some of these very basic principles that we all rely on when we are perceiving a two-dimensional image. And I can do this as well as other people. And so what he did is he formed a collaborative group of three painters, and each year they're called the Anonyma Group, and each year they would make paintings, unidentified paintings about a singular topic. So they had similar to, I think, modeled after a lot of the socialists, and I think in early Marxist ideology, they had a five-year plan. So they one year was going to be size change, and then the next year was value, and the next year was intensity shift, and another year was overlap. So, and then they would show their paintings without identifying, often, which who had painted what painting. That was, I think, a foundational sort of work for him, and then his work became a lot more gestural and struggled between making a painting that was pedagogical and making a painting that was expressive became much richer or went more into conversation. Mm. So the speed of the gesture became, in relation to line or taped areas or contained space, became very vibrant, and his use of color became more amplified and playful. Mm. So in his later years, he died at 56, so he's still, you know, he was quite young when he died.
And you brought up the political implications for work like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of artists are really loath to address the question or address the word political,
mm-hmm.
which is something I can certainly understand. But I wonder whether there also aren't aspects of your work that are political in process.
Well, I think it's political can mean a lot of things. One can mean taking a specific position in society, and an issue that's in society outside of oneself, and using art to emphasize that position. And that's definitely not what I'm doing. I think political can also be personal in a variety of ways. I do think that there are issues in my work about having a... I'm interested in when a viewer comes to my work and feels that they can complete sentences, or they can engage themselves in the making and actually maybe make a better decision than I did. So when I'm performing, for example, and people have said that they've come and said, oh, they thought that they knew what I should do next, what would be the interesting thing to do next. And that projection into a space that's separate from oneself, and the ability to want to engage and to feel the desire to project oneself into what seems outside of oneself, and to act within that space of engagement, and therefore the action in this case may be someone else going out there and doing something else, or finding a way to engage with material that they had felt separate from, that to me would be a political act. And that's where I think my work, if it can work politically, would work politically. In some sense, inspire someone to engage with something they had previously felt separate from, and to actually make choices themselves in how they do things. Not in any way to reproduce my choices or... That is not interesting to me, but to project themselves into the space.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Sure.
Really appreciate it. You've been listening to Invisible. Thanks.